From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Israel's prime minister speaks to a joint session of Congress. What's the reaction from Michigan's Jewish community?
He laid this thing out like he was an attorney presenting his closing argument to a jury.
Hundreds of children aged 13 to 17 are in Michigan adult prisons. What's happening to them inside those prison walls?
Sexual abuse, solitary confinement, tasering, shackling. You simply can't do these things to children.
Dealing with a mother's death through humor, a West Michigan woman does that through her one-woman show, Warm Cheese.
I woke up one day, years after she had passed, and went, you know, I'm done hating her. I don't want to own this anymore.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. But first, the news. There are hundreds of kids aged 13 to 17 inside Michigan's adult prisons. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, what's happening to them inside those prison walls? But first, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu made his much-anticipated speech to Congress today. He made his case against a potential nuclear treaty being negotiated with Iran by major powers, including the United States. There were empty chairs as the prime minister spoke. Some lawmakers, including Michigan Democratic Congressman John Conyers, did not attend the speech. Conyers released a statement saying his decision was based on problems with timing and protocol, not policy. Netanyahu's speech has fired up a lot of controversy, first because he had accepted an invitation from House Speaker John Boehner, and secondly because Israeli elections are March 17th, and this speech before Congress could be viewed as meddling in the electoral affairs of another nation. Arthur Horwitz is publisher and executive editor of the Detroit Jewish News. Mr. Horwitz, welcome to the program.
Great. Thank you for having me on.
What are your thoughts about the prime minister's speech today, particularly the tone? I'm wondering if you felt it was appropriate.
Well, I thought that his speech, looking at it from a few different angles, was actually quite masterful. I thought right out of the gate he diffused, or at least made an earnest effort to diffuse most of the things that created the controversy surrounding his appearance. He underscored the bipartisan support that exists and has existed since the time of Harry Truman for Israel, for the creation of a Jewish state. I thought he went out of his way in subtle ways vis-a-vis Harry Reid and saying a few comments about the now Democratic minority leader. And of course, he went, I thought, very far out of his way to express his gratitude to President Obama in saying very clearly being forever grateful for his support. So I think what he tried to do is kind of have the focus be on the message rather than the messenger. And I think part of the challenge and part of the static, the noise, the anger and back and forth was more about the messenger, in this case the prime minister, and the way that he was invited and how it was communicated and whether the president was or wasn't in the loop. But I think what he did, at least through my lens, is diffuse or at least make him less of the issue and to have the message regarding the threat of a nuclear Iran be the focal point.
And talk more about that message. What did you take away from what he said?
Well, I mean, my takeaway essentially was he laid this thing out like he was an attorney presenting his closing argument to a jury. You know, this is a bad deal. If anybody pulled away from his speech and didn't have that as a bottom line, very forcefully presented message from the prime minister to Congress and by extension, of course, to the American people and the rest of the world, it's a bad deal in his eyes because it rewards an Iranian regime that has been behaving badly and apparently through the prime minister's eyes show no signs of refraining from behaving badly. And I think he also kind of put in there that while this is in the best interests of the world to have no deal rather than a bad deal, He did reinforce that, look, you know, Israel today, the Jewish people by extension today, have the ability to defend themselves, something that they haven't had for a couple of thousand years. And he certainly put out there that, you know, there's a willingness to defend the very existence of the Jewish state of Israel. But I thought the final touches that he put in were very cleverly done. One was injecting Elie Wiesel, the Nobel Peace Prize laureate, Holocaust survivor, author, and essentially looking up to the galleries and saying to Elie Wiesel, never again. And then at the very end, bringing Moses into the conversation as well, pointing out that the chamber that they were all in the House of Representatives, has an image of Moses invoking his final words before passing away, be strong and resolute, neither fear nor dread them. And then the prime minister says, may we neither fear nor dread the challenges ahead. So I thought he, as I said a little earlier, he teed it up well to have the focus be on the message rather than the messenger. And bottom line is, he said, we don't want to do it alone, and God willing, we'll never have to do it alone, but we have the ability, and we're not going to be wiped off the map, despite the fact that Iran has said that it would like to wipe Israel off the map.
I'm speaking with Arthur Horowitz, who's publisher and executive editor of the Detroit Jewish News. There was a piece today, Brookings Institute's Middle East Politics and Policy blog by William Galston, and he pointed out Benjamin Netanyahu, he says, is a man with a mission ensuring that what happened to Jews in the 20th century doesn't happen again in the 21st, that he sees himself as the Jews' Winston Churchill, which certainly reflects what you've just said. And in the same piece, Mr. Galston writes about a Brookings survey that found a majority of Americans figures, well, look, they support U.S. leaders meeting with and talking with the leaders of Iran, even as American support for Israel remains very strong. Do you think Prime Minister Netanyahu changed any American minds today?
My sense is that while he represented that his message was, of course, to America and, of course, to the rest of the world, he was there at the joint session because ultimately his message is to the House and the Senate, and their ability potentially to intervene if a bad deal, as he believes it would be, finds its way, into Congress for some kind of vote, ratification, veto, override of veto, whatever those mechanisms might be. But I did pull out one other thing from this, and I guess we'll know the answer to this one in a couple of weeks or so. I think that while right out of the gate he said this is not political, this is bipartisan, praised President Obama, went into his case, when I looked at him, I said he just got the nod to put together the next government in Israel. I thought that while people were saying that, gee, is the prime minister here to help prop up his re-election back in Israel, I think he presented himself as presidential, if I can call it that, even though he's a prime minister. I think it played very well back home with the center-right parties that ultimately are going to have to decide between Netanyahu or some of the other candidates on the right. And in Israel, it's typically the party that has the most votes, if you will, the most delegates, that is asked by the president of the country to try to form a coalition. So I think what he did, and again, we'll know in 2 or 3 weeks, is going to put him in a position to be asked to put together the next coalition for the Knesset in Israel.
Arthur, we do know that some lawmakers, including Congressman John Conyers, did not attend the joint session. Do you worry that today's speech did hurt Israel's important relationship with America, with its president?
Well, I think there are a lot of bruised feelings, bruised egos. I think that when it comes to the president, when it comes to those who are there on the front lines negotiating with Iran, I think that they believe that they are both doing something that is important first and foremost for the United States, important for Israel, and important for prospects for some kind of change in the paradigm, if I can call it that, in the Middle East. I believe that the message from John Conyers was that there were protocol issues rather than policy differences. So again, I think part of it is messenger and message. And my guess is that while President Obama and Prime Minister Netanyahu were not and have not been the closest of friends, and that this will certainly not bring them closer in that regard, I think that there are folks who did not attend the session, and in their eyes, they were unable, unwilling to separate the messenger from the message.
What do you think, finally, that Michigan's Jewish community is hoping will come out of today's speech?
Well, in generalizations, if I can, I think that Michigan's Jewish community, first and foremost, prays for an Israel that's secure and a region that is peaceful. But I think in many ways, the Jewish community in Michigan is no different than the rest of the residents of Michigan, or really people anywhere, is how do we do the best we can to create a safer, more secure, more peaceful region in the Middle East, in which Israel is an important part. And despite what some people want, it's not going to go away and disappear, and has a right to be there, as do the other countries in the region, too.
Arthur Horwitz, publisher, executive editor of the Detroit Jewish News. Thank you so much for speaking with us today, Arthur.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me.
Still to come, a Michigan performer mixes laughter with grief in her new show, Warm Cheese.
It gives people permission to have feelings. Like, oh my gosh, I'm mad at that dead person. And it's okay to be mad at dead people.
We'll talk with Teresa Tomey. And then a Michigan State professor uses art and math to explore creative ways of thinking and playing. We hear more in 10 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Laugh Fest 2015 starts Thursday in Grand Rapids. 10 days of stand-up comedy films and improv. There'll be a lot of comics from the national scene. Folks like Kathleen Madigan, Wanda Sykes, Patton Oswalt, and more. And Michigan-grown comedians will take the stage as well, including my next guest. Teresa Tomey is a writer, a performer from Grand Rapids. Her act has what undoubtedly will be one of the more memorable names of Laugh Fest. It's called Warm Cheese, and it is where comedy meets grief. Welcome to the program, Teresa.
Thank you so much.
Tell us how comedy and grief are mixing together for Warm Cheese.
Well, I think the topic or the theme du jour of my show is grief, and I don't personally know how to deal with much of anything in life without humor, so it just was inevitable once I started to kind of deal with my mother's passing that humor would take the stage, if you will, to start to understand what was happening for me.
So tell me a little about your mom and your relationship with her.
Sure. I mean, my mom was a nurse. When I talk about her and I write about her and I say things about her, you know, I think this is the most unique thing in the world. Like, nobody had the same mom as I did. And then when you start to share stories, everybody goes, oh, my gosh, that sounds just like my mother. So she's kind of the Midwest mom in some ways. In her instance, she was chronically ill, chronically depressed. So maybe that's not everybody's mother, but that was certainly mine. And chronically angry, kind of as a result of both of those. So when she passed away, I didn't feel grief. I don't know that I even felt relief. It was more of a numbness. I woke up one day years after she had passed and went, you know, I'm done hating her. I don't want to own this anymore. And so I made a decision to try to move into a more loving memory of my mother. And the way for me to do that was to write. And it ended up being this show.
So what kinds of things do you share, and where do the laughs come from? As you talk about this complex relationship with your mom and dealing with her death, where's the room for laughter?
I mean, people are funny. People do funny things. You know, it's like my mom, you know, when she broke her hip at age 63, that prompted her to go out and get a do not resuscitate order, like the DNR. Mm-hmm. And so she made copies of DNRs and put them all over our house and put them on the, you know, in the basement, you know, anywhere she thought she just might die at any moment. So we grew up with DNRs everywhere. And my dad got her a gift certificate to Dr. Kevorkian one year for Christmas, and she said it was the best gift she'd ever gotten. So we just, I don't know. I mean, it's just kind of dealing with these kind of crazy neurotic tendencies that I find humorous.
Well,
and most people do, too. So when I start to talk about them, people laugh. So that's good.
Oh, I think the mother-daughter relationship, it is so fraught. I mean, I can remember seeing aspects of my mom that in no way did I want to repeat in my life. But at the same time, it's mom. So you're drawn to her at the same time that you're pushing yourself away from her.
Yeah, it's a very complex relationship. And what's interesting for me, and this is another theme that I like to explore in the show, is that I have two sisters and a brother. And one sister and one brother and I all kind of have the same relationship with my mom, as well as my dad. We all kind of belong to this same club of not liking mom so much. And then I have a sister who loved my mom. Mm. And so the other dynamic in terms of family relationships is so interesting to me, is how different people have different relationships when you're raised in the same home.
Oh, I bet there's a lot of amens when people are hearing you explore that.
Well, it's true. You know, and even when I say I wake up one day and said I no longer want to hate my dead mother, which is like it's amazing to me how many people go, thank you for saying that. Oh, my God, I hate my dad. Oh, my God. Mm-hmm. You know, and do we hate? What does that even mean? But for me, I mean, it gives people permission to have feelings like, oh, my gosh, I'm mad at that dead person. And it's okay to be mad at dead people.
Well, and it's interesting, you know? Because if you do vent about things, and I know I find this in my life, certain things that I need to vent about, and then I have this feeling she's watching me from beyond and with an eyebrow raised.
Yeah, well, there is a moment in the show where I talk about having a conversation with my dead mother when I was very earnest in having what I believed to be was the presence of my dead mother. And I realized after a 20-minute conversation with her that the thing that I thought was my dead mother was not. I mean, I guess I can share. I mean, I don't want to be so elusive, but it's one of the funnier moments in the show, I think. People tend to react to it. But no, I actually was cleaning my mother's home, and I thought for sure, after she had passed, I thought for sure I was talking to her because I smelled this really weird smell. And trust me, it wasn't my mother.
and we have to go see Warm Cheese to find out what it was.
But I mean, it's so funny. It's like, because sometimes you're just looking and searching for things, so you find the stupidest things. Hmm. For me, I was like, oh, my God, this has to be mother. This has to be. This is what people say. People say, you know, there's smells. Dead people, you'll smell incense or weird smells. So I was convinced it was my mother, you know.
And when we go to see you do your show, Warm Cheese, we're going to find out what it really was.
Yeah.
Has this helped you come to terms with your mom and stop hating her, as you've written about this and you've been performing this one-woman show?
Well, you know, it's very interesting. I would say that the relationship continues to be complex. And it's very funny. I always felt like these comedians had to have tragic lives in order to be funny. You know, I mean, you read about all these, you know, Carol Burnett, who is the child of an alcoholic, mm-hmm. and, you know, all these just horrible situations in which comedians come out of. So there was a part of me that kind of wore my anger with my mother as a badge, too, and was afraid that if I stopped being angry with her, that I would not be funny anymore, which is really twisted and screwed up, but it's what I felt. So there was a part of me that's been kind of afraid to heal the relationship. I will say this, doing the show helps me redefine the relationship, because what I realize is that our dysfunction was meant to serve other people.
Which is what you're doing.
Yeah. Like, I had a woman come up to me and say, Tracy, you don't know me. I'm a nag. I'm such a nag. My daughter is 11. I'm going to be a better mom to her. Because it's not like my mom was Joan Crawford. I mean, she didn't beat us with wire hangers or anything like that. It was just kind of a series of, you know, being raised by somebody who always saw the glass half empty.
Hmm.
And how do you do that? You know, how do you create relationship with that?
Yeah.
One time I said to my mom, I said, you know, it's so hard to tell this story out of context because it just sounds so awful, but I trust you, there's comedy in it. I had read some, you know, Glamour magazine or something, some very important scientific, you know, psychology journal, and it said, if you don't ask people what you want, how can you expect them to give it to you? Actually, in that magazine, it was, if you don't ask a guy for what you want, how can you expect them to give it to you?
Fair enough.
I was like, oh, I'll just ask my mom. That's it. That's what I've screwed up all these years. My mom doesn't know what I want. I just need to ask her. So I asked her for something very specific. I was like, hey, Mom, you know, theater kids always get flowers on opening night. I just want you to know, if you ever thought about it, I'd love to get flowers for opening night. She thought about it, and she went, I make you pie for your birthday. So, I mean, like, that was her resolution. Like,
Oh. You
get pie. I do this for you.
I don't have flowers on opening night in me.
I don't have flowers on opening night, but I get pie for my birthday, you know.
Wow. So. I have to ask you, Teresa, what's the significance of the name Warm Cheese?
Well, it's a moment in the show. I mean, it's very much about who my mom was. It has to do with American cheese slices, and it really, to me, it's kind of like, I make you pie for your birthday. It's who my mom was. She was kind of always saying, take me for who I am. I'm American cheese slice. This is what you get from me. It's not going to be much better than American cheese.
Fair enough. And I think, you know, that's the most that all of us can ask is the people in our lives, take us as we are. Here
yeah,
I am.
Yeah.
Warts
yeah.
and all.
It's hard. It's hard. Yeah, it's definitely hard. Very shortly after I got into some resolution with her and I'd done the show a few times and I could see that people were resonating and I was like, hey, Mom, this is kind of interesting. Maybe we're going to have something good come out of this after all. I found a scrapbook of hers that I never knew existed. My mother took trips after she graduated nurses training in 1953 and drove from Grand Rapids, Michigan to California and wrote letters to her parents, and they collected them all along the way. She never shared those stories, never, any of those stories, so I was able to read all those stories, and it changed the relationship again. I think that what happens in grief and after somebody passes, if we just put the relationship away, it stays what it was. And if we dare to kind of dive into it and look at it more deeply, we can learn a lot more about the person, even with limited information.
Teresa Tomey is an improv performer, a producer, a writer, and a director from Grand Rapids. Her one-woman show, Warm Cheese, is part of LaughFest 2015, which starts this week in Grand Rapids. You can check out all the details and get tickets at laughfestgr.org. That's laughfestgr.org. Teresa, thank you so much for sharing your story with all of us.
Thank you.
They're called ambigrams, and a Michigan State University professor is using these designs to explore creative ways of thinking and playing. His designs are now on display at the MSU Museum. Punya Mishra is a professor of educational psychology and educational technology. And Punya, I have to confess, I'd never even heard that word ambigram before, and then I found out I'm not alone. What is an ambigram?
Well, thank you for having me. An ambigram is just a way of writing words so that they can be read in multiple ways. And this term was actually coined by Douglas Hofstadter, the cognitive scientist, and he took the word ambi and gram, so ambiguity and letter, you know, like a grammatical element. And so designs that you can create with these can read the same when you rotate them by 180 degrees, like you turn the paper, or you reflect them in a mirror. There's just a whole gamut of them. I mean, there's a whole Wikipedia page devoted to all different kinds of ambigrams.
Yeah, in fact, I'm looking at some right now as we talk on from your website, deep-play.com, so people can kind of get an idea of what it is you're talking about. What do they do for us?
Well, I started it just because it is like one of those nice, interesting puzzles that you can play with. But over time, I've come to realize that it sort of gives some insight into sort of the underlying math of space. So things like rotation, reflection, translation, these are sort of the elementary things we talk about when we talk about geometry. And as I started exploring that, it became sort of this really interesting, fascinating sort of learning experience for me, and was also this crossing this boundary between sort of mathematics and art. And I'm neither a mathematician, you know, professionally, I'm not really an artist, but it was kind of this interesting space where I could sort of explore some of these ideas. And I think also managed to convey to people a sense of play and wonder about both mathematics and design, because there is a strong aesthetic component to these designs as well, because many of the ones that I make, I don't even put up there anywhere because they don't look right. And I think if you talk to mathematicians, they also speak about sort of elegance and, you know, the proofs that they create. And so it became this really interesting space for me to just sort of think and play with ideas.
And you use that term deep play. What does that mean?
Well, I mean, when we were thinking about the exhibition and so on. I mean, that's also the name of my research group here at Michigan State, by the way. So we struggled a lot with, like, what would be a name that would capture what it is that we want to do, because a lot of time we see in schools today, the idea of play is almost sort of ignored. You have no recess, you have no this, you have no that. And we strongly value this importance of play. In fact, we just wrote an article about how even evolutionarily play evolved as a way of making learning fun and happen. But we also wanted to distinguish ourselves from saying, oh, this is sort of superficial, some kind of a fluff, kind of a play. But it is really play with ideas. So I try really hard, for instance, in these ambigrams I create, to be true to the mathematics. So that's why I have a math friend. You know, he has a PhD in math. He keeps me honest about that. And so we wanted to capture this idea of playing seriously. You know, how can we push the boundaries of both sort of the art and the math, but be honest to both the disciplines.
And do you see this being able to be inserted into classroom routines in Michigan, where we could get our young people thinking this way?
I think that there are some broader themes or ideas which I think can play a part. I mean, I have done some workshops with kids and with teachers about some of these ideas. But I think the deeper idea is that, you know, I do research on creativity and teacher creativity and so on, that creativity comes out of putting together ideas from different disciplines in new and novel and unique sort of combinations. And only when you have a foundation which is broad that cuts across disciplines, can you make that happen? If you have a very narrow sort of perspective, there is no way you can get new ideas to come in. And so that's why the arts and playing and things like that become so important, because that's where the sort of combinatorial explosion can possibly happen. And so we've been sort of working on developing these ideas both in theory and in terms of our research that we do. So I see a lot of potential for that. We do live in a climate which is very test-driven, you know, and those have put significant constraints on teachers and what they can do. But in a world where we cannot predict what the world is going to look like 5-10 years from now, it seems to me that creativity and thinking about those ideas is very important. So I do think there is a lot of value in this, in the broader ideas that underlie this.
And in fact, we hear this conversation back and forth in Michigan about the big push toward the STEAM classes, or, you mm-hmm. know, and really the math and the technology and the engineering and the science, and then kind of peeling off from the arts. You're kind of uniting them.
Well, I mean, my work, I mean, I do a bit of historical work on sort of scientists and, you know, artists and so on. It keeps telling me over and over again that a creative scientist has interests which are outside of science, and those influence how they succeed. So, I mean, just to give a quick example, Alexander Fleming, the person who discovered penicillin, he used to love to play with bacteria. He used to make paintings with bacteria. And he argues that that's what made him notice that little black spot one day, when other chemists would have just thrown the Petri dish away. So it's his interest in art and, you know, and his sort of willingness to play with things that led to the discovery.
You were very inspired when you discovered Mahatma Gandhi actually tried to create ambigrams. What did he do?
That was like one of those weird, interesting coincidences where, so he had taken the letter M and tried to write it both as the letter M in English and so that it could read or M, which is the M sound in Hindi. And he had done Karamchand, which is his middle name, K, trying to write it as a K and a K. You know, it's kind of fascinating to me, but it also, to me, spoke to the sort of the idea of play. If you think about 1947, this is a few months before he was assassinated. This is a few months after maybe his greatest sorrow, which was the partition of India. But even within that, he had this sort of sense of play with little shapes and letters. And to me, that's sort of a hallmark of a creative person, is that they mess around and muck around with things all the time. And they may not be greatly successful at many of the things they do, but it feeds into, I think, the passions and the creativity show in their own discipline.
The exhibit runs till the end of June at the Michigan State University Museum, and you can see examples of Punya's ambigrams by going to the website deep-play.com. That's deep-play.com. Punya Mishra, Professor of Educational Psychology and Educational Technology at Michigan State University. It was a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much.
Support for arts and culture coverage on Stateside comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs and the National Endowment for the Arts. Still to come, rape of prisoners under 17 years old is a serious, serious problem in this nation, so much so that Congress passed the Prison Rape Elimination Act in 2003. But is Michigan doing enough to protect young prisoners from rape? That comes up next. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. If you are 17 years old and you break a law and are convicted here in Michigan, you're going to be tried as an adult. Michigan is one of a handful of states where that happens, getting tried as an adult. And virtually every state allows prosecutors or judges to pursue sentencing of a 17-year-old as an adult in specific cases. So what happens once those young people are in prison? Stories of teens being sexually assaulted in adult prisons led Congress to pass the Prison Rape Elimination Act. That was in 2003. My next guest is an attorney who believes Michigan is not doing what it should to protect young offenders when they're in prison. Deborah LaBelle is director of the Juvenile Life Without Parole Initiative with the ACLU. Welcome, Deborah.
Thank you for having me.
What do you think sets Michigan apart in the way that it treats young people who break the law?
So actually, Michigan is now one of nine and soon to be one of eight states only that treat 17-year-olds directly as adults, as if they're adults for all infractions they have with the law. But Michigan goes even further. 13, 14, 15, and 16-year-olds are also treated as adults in Michigan for a wide variety of law-breaking, and they are placed directly in adult prisons when they're sentenced and convicted for a range of mostly property crimes. So we have hundreds of children aged 13 to 17 in Michigan's adult prisons. And the kind of harm that's been wrought to them ranges from the sexual abuse that you talked about, but it's also solitary confinement, tasering, shackling, all of the things that if we looked at Michigan's protection and neglect laws, which say children is everyone under 18, you simply can't do these things to children. And if any parent or guardian were caught doing these things, shackling, putting them in closets, putting them in holes for months, they would be found criminally guilty of abuse and neglect. But the state is doing it with impunity.
How many states is that a situation in where you're seeing these children 13 to 17?
So there are many states that say for certain crimes, youth can be tried as adults. Many, many states do that.
Right. Depends on the crime.
California, for example. Mm-hmm. But they never put their children in adult prisons. They hold them until they're 18, 19, 20, 21, recognizing that youth in adult prisons with adult prisoners are prey. That's what the Prison Rape Elimination Act specifically was trying to address, to say, listen, if you put children in with adults, they are going to become the first victims. And so there are only a handful of states right now. The only one I know of that goes as young as 14 is Florida, but they keep their youth very separate from adults, a completely different unit.
Tell us about the lawsuit that you have filed.
What happened is, in the context of working actually with the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, we started to get letters from youth who were in the adult prisons. And to put children in adult prisons is a complete human rights violation, violates the Declaration of the Rights of Man. And the United States is literally the only country that does this. And so we started to interview them, a number of us, and working in conjunction with some people from the International Human Rights Clinic in New York at Columbia Law School. And more youth, we are finding, were reporting really deep abuse, sexual assaults from adult prisoners where they were put in the same cell with, as well as sexual abuse from staff. Children don't belong in adult prisons, and there's, you know, a good reason for it. You think of the kind of rehabilitation that kids need. Mm-hmm. It's totally anathema to what goes on in the adult prisons and what you do for adults. As we know as parents, as we know as children ourselves, we can remember the kind of punishment that is wreaked on children just doesn't work for them. It doesn't help them rehabilitate. And for Michigan, we have hundreds of kids coming out much more damaged than when they went in.
Are you filing this on behalf of one prisoner? Is this what's behind this case?
So we have a federal lawsuit and a state lawsuit. And recently, the state court judge certified this as a class action, which was upheld by the Court of Appeals. And so it's a class of youth. Right now, we have had over 250 youth come to us and say they were injured in this way in Michigan during the relevant time frame. I think there will be many more.
I would imagine it's hard to get any kind of hard and fast numbers because they're probably terrified to speak.
They are. I mean, it's a very real problem. If youth speak out and they're kept in the same prison as the people who raped them, I mean, the threats of violence are not made up in their heads. You know, they're not illusionary. It's the threat that you will be hurt. One of my clients just last week was stabbed 27 times, and only that he had all of his clothes on and his coat because it's so cold allowed him to survive. And those were three adult male prisoners who stabbed him. So I think that they're terrified. I don't think that there's sufficient protection. The protection that is often offered is to be put in, quote, protective custody, which is the whole.
Solitary. So it's happening because guards don't care, guards aren't aware, guards are not enough. Why is it happening?
So I think that it's very hard to not know in a prison. There are cameras everywhere. Everybody's movements are regulated. You get misconduct tickets for being a moment out of place. So to say that you don't know that children are being raped in the prison, I think is not a credible assertion. I think what happens is that for a long time, there's been acceptance of sexual abuse in the prisons. We know as a society, we all know about it.
It's the way it is.
We think about it. That, you know, yeah. There are jokes about it. There are films about it. Mm-hmm. Shawshank Redemption. This is nothing new to us.
Sure.
And so what has happened and what the reason we had the Prison Rape Elimination Act is that children are particularly vulnerable and are often, I think the staff turn their head because it's a way of controlling things. If it's going to happen, then it has to be somehow regulated. And the youth don't fight back.
When we talk about this situation in Michigan and when you see these 13 to 17-year-olds, where and how did that trend begin?
I think that in the 90s, there was this sort of bugaboo, you know, of mm-hmm. our youth, our children were going to become these super predators. And it was particularly strong in Michigan, where the governor at the time, Governor Engler, said he was going to build punk prisons for kids. Somehow we walked away from the fact that children are our most vulnerable assets for our future, that we have to protect them as a society, to fearing them. Well, it turned out not to be true, this concept that there was going to be a new group of youth who were immoral and that would create all this violence and havoc. But during that time, we started lowering the age of which kids could be put in prison. We stopped being transparent about who is doing this and how many children, so that what is astonishing to me, and I was at an event in D.C. in which the State Department, the Bureau of Prisons, there were state actors there. And when we asked how many youth are in adult prisons and jails in this country, no one knew. No one knew, because we don't keep track of them. They're not counted. And they're just pulled out of their communities, and they're missing. And we know in Michigan, for example, the majority of youth are there for property crimes. And the majority of them could have served their sentence in a youth facility and gone home. Instead, they enter an adult prison, which we all know, and have this harm wrought on them, stumble out. And the data is irrefutable that youth who go into adult prisons there is a public safety risk. They recidivate. Mm-hmm. And that if you treat children like children and say, okay, they're kids, they do these things, and they also come sometimes from broken homes, and we have failed them in many ways, but we can help them now, that you can actually reduce crime by treating youth in the juvenile facilities.
I'm speaking with Ann Arbor attorney Deborah LaBelle, who's director of the Juvenile Life Without Parole Initiative, as we talk about the Prison Rape Elimination Act and whether it's working, whether it's not, and the fact that there are children in adult prisons in Michigan. I'm going to put out two names that are going to be widely recognized. Ihab Maslamani, he was 17. Robert Taylor was 16 when they kidnapped Matthew Landry of Chesterfield Township in 2009. Middle of the afternoon, he was at a sandwich shop. They drove him around for 8 hours, and then they took him to a house in Detroit, and they shot him in the back of his head. And they actually recently tried and failed to get their sentences reduced, and a Macomb County judge resentenced them to life without parole. What do you say to those who say that was a heinous crime? They got what they deserved. We don't care if they were 16 or 17 at the time.
So there's a little bit difference in the sentencing there. The Supreme Court recently said in the Miller case that for youth who commit the harshest of crimes, mm-hmm. homicide, you have to consider their youthful status before you mm-hmm. sentence them. But those youth would get long sentences no matter what, whether they got life without parole or in Michigan they could get 25 to 60. Those are the only two sentences. But prior to their being 18, there's no reason to put them in an adult prison.
Even with what was done?
Even with what they were done, their sentence is to serve a long time in prison. It's true. Mm-hmm. But their sentence is not to be thrown out to be raped and to be abused as children. They can be kept safely in, there's a Maxie Boys School. There are other youth who have committed homicides who are mm-hmm. kept. But as children, they shouldn't be punished in addition to their sentence. Their sentence is their sentence. Mm-hmm. That's their punishment.
What are you seeking in this lawsuit? What's the lawsuit asking of the state of Michigan?
The lawsuit's asking that children not be put in adult prisons, period, that they should not be transferred into the adult prison. And the majority of them who have done, as I say, property crimes can be successfully kept in education and have rehabilitation and return to our communities without any further harm being wrought on them. And I don't think this is a big issue, but at a great economic savings to the state. So what's going on now is to place a child in an adult prison is extremely expensive. And I also think that, I think that we would ask that Michigan join the majority of states in this country and not put children in adult prisons. There are plenty of effective ways to keep kids educated, to keep them rehabilitated, and bring them back to our community without the extraordinary cost of what's going on now, both in economic and in human terms. And I think that you simply would not have adult prisoners raping children if they weren't in the same place with adult prisoners. You would not have children subjected to solitary confinement, shackling, and tasering, which happens in adult prisons. It does not happen in the juvenile prisons. Michigan also does an incredibly unusual thing. They have a good law called the Holmes Youthful Trainee Act, in which if a kid commits a property offense for the first time, it's recognized that you should have a second chance. So courts sentence them to probation, and if they successfully complete probation, then their crime is right free. They don't have a felony. They move on. They grow up. They finish high school. They get jobs. They go to college. But in Michigan, it allows those youth under that act to go and serve their probation in prison. So you have kids in prison who are in prison for minor in possession, for in prison for fleeing a police officer on school grounds, who are actually in the adult prisons serving their probation. And many counties do this to save money. Washtenaw is not among them. Washtenaw, they're doing their probation at the Humane Society, the Neutral Zone, the Habitat for Humanity, while they're still going to school and living at home. But there are hundreds of kids who under this act are actually in adult prisons and subject to all of the types of abuse that I've just talked about.
Now, the lawsuit you filed, did you file that in Washtenaw court?
It is in Washtenaw, yes.
And I'm wondering why Washtenaw when there are no prisons in Washtenaw County?
Well, the main defendant lives in Washtenaw County. That would be Governor Snyder.
Okay. I wondered, was there a thought that perhaps there would, a judge in Washtenaw County might be more sympathetic to the case?
No, I think that the main defendant was the governor who lives here. And, you know, there are actually prisons in Washtenaw County. This also includes girls. And so the women's prison is in Washtenaw County. And girls are put at the age of 13 in general population at the women's facility.
What kind of timetable? What are you looking forward to happening and in what point of period of time?
To date, the state has fought this very hard, both in the federal case and in the state case. In a little over a year since we filed, I think there have been 14 appeals and 13 requests to stay all proceedings. So we're not moving as quickly as I would hope, but we would look forward to beginning trial in this case within the next year.
Deborah, what drove you to this work that you feel so passionately about?
I mean, I think in this specific case.
In general, looking at this problem of children in prisons and this the whole issue of juvenile offenders, what drove you to that?
I think I deeply believe that, you know, children are our best resource and that we really owe something to them. We should protect them. They're our children. I unfortunately see that the majority of youth who are in the prisons are children of color. And I don't think failing them and then punishing them is the way a society should act. And I also recognize that and see many other children of privilege, both by class and by racial identity, who do the exact same things, but they don't go to prison.
Deborah LaBelle, director of the Juvenile Life Without Parole Initiative with the ACLU and an attorney based in Ann Arbor. Deborah, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Show on air, you can now catch us on iTunes. Just search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. And while you're there, give us a review. We'd really like to hear what you think. And of course, we're on Facebook and Twitter at Stateside Radio and always at MichiganRadio.org and click the link that says Stateside. Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Today's engineer was Peg Watson. Contributors are Mike Blank, Emily Fox, Haley Hirschman, Mercedes Mejia, and Annie Norris. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.